Hello, it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, March 18th, 2023. My name is John Reef. I'll be bringing you the news today. I do apologize for not being there for the last few weeks. I have been sick, but I am on the mend now. Here's a look at what we'll be reading. We'll start with the weather, then do the mini editorial on the front page, and the other stories on the front page, and then moving to the inside pages for more stories of local interest. At the 30-minute mark, we'll do the obituaries, and we'll have some sports and feature stories as time allows, wrapping up with Dear Abby and the weather one more time. For today, brisk and cold with periods of sun, a high of 22 degrees today and winds northwest at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, going to be absolutely frigid, a low of 6 degrees and winds northwest at 7 to 14 miles an hour under a starry sky. And then not as cold on Sunday. We might have gotten through all this finally and into spring. Plenty of sunshine tomorrow, a high of 44 degrees and winds south-southwest at 8 to 16 miles an hour. Sunday night, a low of 25 under mostly clear skies, then partly sunny and milder, a high of 51. Winds out of the southwest at south-southwest at 8 to 16 miles an hour. Monday night, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 29, then some sun, then turning cloudier on Tuesday, a high of 52 degrees, and winds again out of the south-southeast. This time it's 8 to 16 miles an hour. 37 will be the low on Tuesday night under cloudy skies, and then cloudy, a couple of showers on Wednesday, a high of 53, and east-northeast winds at 8 to 16 miles an hour. On the mini editorial, it's today from the Journal Editorial Board, and it reads as follows: Is your final four bracket busted yet? Number 2 seed Arizona and number 4 seed Virginia were ousted in opening day play Thursday. Who might be the next squad to be sent home early? Again, that from the Journal Editorial Board, and obviously before last night's Purdue loss, which put a salvage title on my own bracket. Taking a look at the top story on the front page, Retro Look for Ragbri logo. And this is Dateline Sioux City and by Earl Horlick. A splash of orange, yellow, and deep purple will dominate the official logo for Sioux City's 50th anniversary of hosting the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, or Ragbri. Ragbri starts off in Sioux City on July 22nd, ending in Davenport on July 29th. The logo and the slogan, "You Never Forget Your First Ride," was unveiled at a news conference held at the Sioux City Arts Center Friday morning. Graphic designer Jeff Gordon created the logo imagery, which included a bicycle, the state of Iowa, waterways, the local skyline, as well as the cities Sioux City and Davenport, which were both represented by violet hearts. The distinctively groovy front was inspired by both That 70s Show and t-shirts made at Market, a since-closed custom printing shop that was located at the Southern Hills Mall during Ragbri's first decade. Mostly, I wanted to highlight 50 years of Ragbri with all that dominated advertising back in 1973, Gordon, a member of the local publicity committee, explained. The logo will be featured on t-shirts, signs, posters, emails, and in the media. Nobody was happier for Sioux City being Ragbri's kickoff community than Siouxland Cyclists President Ron Benoche. Ragbri had started in Sioux City 7 times before: 1973, 78, 88, 93, 2001, 2010, and 2015, he said. Since Ragbri started in Lamar's in 2021 and Sergeant Bluff in 2022, I was worried that they would bypass Sioux City. Instead, Sioux City will kick off Ragbri for an 8th time. I think it's going to be wonderful, Benoche said. Ragbri began when Des Moines Register reporters John Karras and Donald Call decided to bike across Iowa and invited others to join them. The initial year had 114 riders. The number exploded in subsequent years and is now a major summer event across the state of Iowa. More than 17,000 riders have already registered, and most of the metro hotels are already booked. Chris Larson Park and Riverside Park will serve as campgrounds for registered cyclists. Cook Park will be the location for unregistered riders. The Tyson Event Center and Long Lines Family Rec Center parking lot will host the entertainment and bike expo area. Sioux City is excited for the 50th anniversary of RAGBRAI, Sioux City RAGBRAI Chair Matt Salvatore said. RAGBRAI can showcase Sioux City like no other event and create a powerful economic impact. Cyclists and their support team from across the country and around the globe will flood Sioux City to eat in our restaurants, stay in our hotels, shop, buy gas, and more, he added. On the front page, it shows a picture of the logo they have. It shows, says, you never forget your first ride. It, in the corner, it says, lower right corner, it says 50 years. It shows the skyline, as it said, purple hearts where Sioux City and Davenport are. Below it, it says Sioux City. The only thing it doesn't actually say is RAGBRAI on it. All right, take a look at the next story. Actually, it's just a big inset picture on the front page. It's for the St. Patrick's Day Parade that happened last evening, and it shows people dressed in garb throwing candy and beads from floats during the St. Patrick's Day Parade in downtown Sioux City on Friday. Next story on the front page, Monona County Sheriff to retire. This by Nick Hytrek and Dateline Ottawa. Jeff Pratt's fishing boat just might make it out of the garage this summer. His duties as Monona County Sheriff often kept him too busy to put his boat in the water as often as he would have liked. They also cut into spending time with his grandchildren. He'll have more time for both come March 31st when he retires after more than 22 years in office. I'm ready to relax and do something different, said Pratt, who was first elected sheriff in 2000. A Sioux City native and 1984 West High graduate, Pratt, 57, said the timing was right to retire now rather than waiting until his current term expires. He said he's reached the maximum level for state employee retirement benefits and has been offered an opportunity to join a friend in the insurance business, a way to continue to provide protection to Monona County residents, but in a different way and at a slower pace. I think it will be good stress relief, Pratt said. By retiring midterm, it gives the next sheriff a chance to serve and decide if he or she likes the job enough to run for election in 2024. Pratt's 33-year law enforcement career will have been spent entirely in Monona County. He began working with the Ottawa Police Department in 1990 before joining the sheriff's office in 1993. He rejoined the Ottawa Police Force in 1996, ascending to the chief's position before he was elected sheriff, and spent the past two decades in the office overseeing a 24-person staff. During that tenure, he was involved in the response to major tornadoes at the Little Sioux Scout Ranch near Blencoe in 2008 and in Mapleton in 2011. Missouri River flooding in 2011 also required long hours spent monitoring the rising waters and the subsequent cleanup. Pratt said he developed lasting friendships working with other responders during those events. He'll miss being part of that response team, but plans on remaining involved as a volunteer rather than in a law enforcement capacity. He decided that when he retires, he's hanging up his gun belt for good. I have enjoyed doing what I do. I have enjoyed working with the people in the county. Monona County is a great place to live, he said. Monona County Board of Supervisors Chairman Bo Fox said the board will announce plans for Pratt's replacement on March 31st. The board could appoint a new sheriff or call for a special election to fill the office. It shows an inset picture on page A4 of Monona County Sheriff Jeff Pratt standing at an entrance to the county's jail inside the Public Safety Center in Ottawa in February of 2020. Elected in sheriff in 2000, Pratt will retire March 31st after a 33-year career in law enforcement. Last story on the front page is more of a national story, but it has local effects here. In nursing homes, the impoverished live their final days on pennies. This is by Matt Sadinsky, Dateline, Philadelphia. New pants to replace Alex Morrissey's tattered khakis will have to wait. There's no cash left for sugar-free cookies either. Even at the month's start, the budget is so bare that Fixident is a luxury. Now, halfway through it, things are so tight that even a Diet Pepsi is a stretch. How many years do I have left? Asks 82-year-old Morrissey, who lives in a Philadelphia nursing home. I want to live those as well as I can, but to some degree, you lose your dignity. Across the U.S., hundreds of thousands of nursing home residents are locked in a wretched bind. Driven into poverty, forced to hand over all income, and left to live on an allowance as low as $30 a month. In a long-term care system that subjects some of society's frailest to daily indignities, Medicaid's personal needs allowance, as the stipend is called, is among the most ubiquitous yet least known. Nearly two-thirds of American nursing home residents have their care paid for by Medicaid, and in exchange, all Social Security, pension, and other income is rerouted to go toward their bill. The personal needs allowance is meant to pay for anything not provided by the home, from a phone to clothes to a birthday present for a grandchild. One problem, Congress hasn't raised the allowance in decades. Quote, it's really one of the most humiliating things for them, end quote, says Sam Brooks, an attorney for the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care, which advocates for nursing home residents and has urged an increase in the allowance. Quoting again, it can really be a point of shame, especially when an individual has no close relatives or no one able to financially help. The allowance can breed striking need. When Marla Carter visits her mother-in-law at a nursing home in Owensboro, Kentucky, the scene feels more 19th century poorhouse than modern day America. With just a $40 allowance, residents are dressed in ill-fitting hand-me-downs or hospital gowns that drape open. Some have no socks or shoes. Basic supplies can run low. Many don't have a pen to write with. That was what was so surprising to us, Carter says, the poverty. Medicaid was created in 1965, and a 1972 amendment established the personal needs allowance set at a minimum of $25 each month. Had it been linked to inflation, it would be about $180 today. But regular cost of living increases were not built into the allowance, and Congress has raised the minimum rate only once to $30 in 1987. It has remained there ever since. Some politicians have tried to fix the problem, including Representative Jennifer Wexton, a Democrat from Virginia, who in 2019 introduced a bill to raise the minimum allowance to $60 and cement annual increases tied to those for Social Security. It didn't even get a hearing. Quote, I was shocked. It's about dignity for these people, end quote, Wexton said. Faced with federal inaction, states have taken it upon themselves to raise allowances. Even so, most remain low. A majority of states, 28, have allowances of $50 or less, according to a state-by-state survey by the American Council on Aging. Just five states grant residents $100 or more each month, including Alaska, which stands alone in offering $200 monthly, the maximum under federal law. Four states, Alabama, Illinois, North Carolina, and South Carolina, remain at the $30 minimum. As soon as I get it, it's gone, says Chris Hackney, a 74-year-old resident of a nursing home in Durham, North Carolina, who spends his $30 monthly allowance on body wash, toothpaste, deodorant, and some items his facility used to provide but has cut back on, like wipes and diapers. Down the hall, 56-year-old Janine Cox gets an occasional bag of chips from the vending machine and scrimps to add to the collection plate at church. Her neighbors are even worse off. Quote, it's like a fight for them to survive another day, end quote, she says. With no financial wiggle room, nursing home residents find what little freedom they have evaporates even more, putting out of reach the chance to take a taxi to see a friend, to get lost in a newly purchased book, or to escape the monotony of the cafeteria with some takeout food. Even after 2 years of institutionalized life, it is a confounding truth for Morrissey. With each $45 allowance he receives, a monthly juggling act begins. Can his razors last a bit longer to put off refills? Can he squeeze a bit more out of the fixident tube? Has he cut corners enough to get some aftershave or peanut butter crackers? It's the little things, he says. You don't think about these things until you no longer have them. He is a lifelong Quaker, has always cherished living simply, and accepts his situation with a smile, but it doesn't seem too much, he says, to ask for a soda. Shows a picture inset on page A4 of Alex Morrissey calculating his finances and how much he would have left if he were to buy himself a pair of pants February 15th at a nursing home in Philadelphia. Hundreds of thousands of nursing home residents in the U.S. rely on Medicaid's personal needs allowance as their only source of income. On the front page, it shows an inset picture of Alex Morrissey as he sits for a portrait in his room February 15th at a nursing home in Philadelphia. Moving now to page A2, former chief pleads not guilty of stalking. This is by Nick Heitrek and Dateline Lamars. The former Kingsley, Iowa police chief has pleaded not guilty of stalking his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend and illegally using his position to access information about them. James Dunn, 54, entered his written plea Friday in Plymouth County District Court to 14 counts of unauthorized access to or dissemination of intelligence data, 3 counts of misconduct in office, and 2 counts of stalking. The charges are a mix of felonies and misdemeanors. A trial date has not yet been set. Dunn is accused of using Kingsley Police Department computers several times from November through February to search law enforcement databases for information about his ex-girlfriend, her boyfriend, and the boyfriend's roommate. According to court documents, Dunn and the woman broke up in November, and when he learned she was seeing another man in Hinton, Iowa, he began following or searching for her, prompting her to tell him not to contact her. On February 6th, court documents said Dunn left an anonymous letter that included descriptions of his sex life with the woman taped to her boyfriend's front door. He also described watching his ex-girlfriend and her boyfriend, telling them he knew where they had gone to dinner the night before. Dunn later told the woman's mother she had cheated on him and that her new boyfriend had a criminal history and was on probation. The woman contacted Hinton police, telling them she was afraid of Dunn and that he was armed at all times. Dunn was arrested February 15th by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation agents who had been notified by Hinton police of complaints about Dunn. Dunn had served as Kingsley's police chief since February 1st, 2022. He was initially placed on administrative leave after his arrest and has since resigned. Next story on page A2, as justices consider student loan forgiveness, many states expand their own programs. As the U.S. Supreme Court mulls the constitutionality of President Joe Biden's broad student loan forgiveness plan, lawmakers in many states are looking to expand their own student debt repayment programs. Every state but North Dakota has at least one loan forgiveness plan. The catch is that most of the 129 state plans are tailored to just a single industry or profession, such as doctors, teachers, police officers, or farmers. Or the plans are targeted to people who agree to work in places with a dire need for their services. Maine, for example, awards forgivable loans to high school, college, or graduate students who are state residents and intend to become teachers. But recipients must repay the money with interest if they end up working out of state. California has a loan repayment program for physicians, dentists, nurse practitioners, and other health care providers who agree to practice in areas with a shortage of those professionals. In contrast, Biden's plan would provide loan forgiveness of up to $20,000 for any individual borrower making less than $125,000. But the same factors driving Biden's plan, namely the fast rising cost of higher education and the mountain of debt Americans have accumulated to pay for it, are spurring many states to consider expanding their plans. At least 24 bills are moving through legislatures this spring. Nearly 44 million borrowers owe a total of $1.6 trillion in federal student loan debt, an average of $37,574 per person, according to the Education Data Initiative and Education Research Group. Quote, I think there's been a lot of pressure over the past 5 or 10 years for states to step in due to the weight of student debt, end quote, said Adam Minsky, a Boston lawyer whose practice is devoted to helping student loan borrowers. Quote, if the Supreme Court strikes down Biden's initiative, it would add pressure for states to step in, end quote. Minsky said he doesn't think a ruling that strikes down Biden's program would adversely affect state programs, largely because the state plans are so narrowly tailored. The legal challenge to Biden's order revolves around a post-9/11 law that gives the Secretary of Education the power to forgive the student loans of borrowers affected by a war or national emergency. The plaintiffs, 6 Republican attorneys general, are challenging the Biden administration's argument that the COVID-19 pandemic was a qualifying emergency. Minsky, who is also the author of a handbook on student loans aimed at lawyers and law students, said it's unlikely any state would adopt a broad plan like Biden's, mostly because of the open-ended cost. State programs, including the ones under consideration by legislatures this year, generally are capped. Georgia lawmakers are considering at least 4 bills, including one that would repay loans for college graduates who become law enforcement officers. Republican State Senator Beau Hatchett said he introduced that bill on behalf of GOP Governor Brian Kemp, who included the plan in his budget. Both the House and the Senate have passed versions of the legislation, and as soon as one chamber passes the other's bill, it will be sent to Kemp for his signature. Quote, law enforcement officers are critical to the state, but often they are faced with seeking other careers to pay off their loans, end quote, Hatchett said in a phone interview. The bills would allocate $3.2 million to fund loan repayment for up to 800 officers, up to $20,000 per officer, in exchange for 5 years of service in a law enforcement role in Georgia. He said the program will be open, first come, first served, regardless of what major the officer's degree is in. Across the state of Georgia and across the country, we're seeing a shortage of law enforcement officers. That was a quote, he said. Continuing the quote, who are critical to protecting the citizens of the state and who are heeding the call of public service, end quote. Kemp is one of 22 Republican governors who signed a letter opposing Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. In an email to Stateline, Kemp's spokesperson, Garrison Douglas, said, there is no comparison, since Biden's plan was, quote, formed by executive fiat, end quote, while the legislative branch is shaping the Georgia program. The other bills in Georgia would forgive college loans for certain nursing faculty, medical examiners, and General Assembly staff members. The nursing faculty and medical examiner bills have each been approved by one chamber. Representatives from both parties and other legislatures are also working on expanding financial assistance for certain kinds of workers. 2 bills in New York, for example, would increase the amount of student loan reimbursement from $3,400 per year to as much as $8,000 per year for attorneys serving the indigent. Staying on page A2, moving now to the briefs. Judge finds man guilty of setting fire in Sioux City. This Dateline Sioux City. A judge has found a Sioux City man guilty of setting a fire that severely damaged an after-hours club. In a verdict filed Friday, District Judge Todd Deck found Valen Jackson guilty of second-degree arson, first-degree criminal mischief, and third-degree burglary for the August 22, 22nd, 2021 fire at the Esquire Club. Sentencing was scheduled for May 12th in Woodbury County District Court. Deck presided over the February trial and ruled that evidence overwhelmingly showed Jackson, 37, entered the club at 414 West 7th Street and lighted three incendiary devices, spreading them throughout the club. The building, which was empty at the time, sustained more than $100,000 in fire, smoke, and heat damage. The fire caused approximately $20,000 in damage to personal property. Jackson had been at the club hours earlier and returned after it had closed with another man who remains unidentified. After his arrest, Jackson described to police the three bottles of fuel stuffed with rags he used to start the fire and where he placed them before he and the other man left the building. Jackson told police he set the fire so the building could no longer be used as an after-hours club because he believed it was being operated in a manner that was detrimental to the community. The case was suspended for several months to determine if Jackson was mentally competent to stand trial. Next story, DCI investigating Central Lyon Schools, the state line Rock Rapids. State law enforcement authorities have launched an investigation into a person who has had contact with Central Lyon Community School students. Superintendent Brent Jorth said in a news release that he was informed by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation that a non-district employee who has had interactions with students is under investigation. Quote, "We know that our entire school community is as stunned as we were by this news," end quote, George said in the news release. No details of the circumstances of the interactions, what type of activity may have occurred, or the grade level of the students involved were given. The allegations are considered to be severe, according to the news release, and the person who is under investigation no longer has access to students or school facilities. DCI Special Agent in Charge Steve Van Otterloo said the investigation is ongoing and he would not release any details about the allegations or the suspect. No arrests have been made, Van Otterloo said. The school district is cooperating with the DCI, and George said he cannot comment any further on the investigation. Next story, Junior League hosts prom pop-up, this Dateline Sioux City. Junior League of Sioux City, the JLSC, is hosting a prom dress shopping event from noon to 5 p.m. Saturday today at the Junior League's headquarters at 316 West 7th Street. During the Dream Dress pop-up, girls can shop for a wide variety of dresses, all priced at $25. The event, which was helped by a donation from Dream Dress Express, was created in an effort to help Siouxland girls find their dream dress in time for the prom season. Prom has become an expensive rite of passage, placing a financial burden on many families. JLSC wants to alleviate some of that financial burden while still giving girls a boutique-like shopping experience. Quote, "Every girl deserves a dress that makes her feel incredible on prom day," end quote, event chair Justine Sponder said. Junior League of Siouxland is an organization of women committed to promoting volunteerism, developing the potential of women, and improving the community through effective action and leadership of trained volunteers. Next story, fire damages Vermilion Church, the state-led Vermilion, South Dakota. Fire damaged a Vermilion church early Thursday. Firefighters were dispatched to Apostolic Faith Church, 415 Cottage Avenue, at 3:11 a.m. for a reported structure fire. Upon arrival, firefighters observed smoke coming from the attic vents and requested mutual aid from Gayville and Elk Point fire departments. Firefighters entered the building and extinguished the fire, which caused moderate damage, by 4:48 a.m. No one was in the building at the time of the fire, and there were no injuries. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. Last story on the briefs, man sentenced for sexual exploitation of a minor. This Dateline Sioux City, a previously convicted sex offender was sentenced Thursday to 25 years in federal prison for taking pictures of himself having sexual contact with an underage girl. Kenneth Miller, 30, of Sioux City, pleaded guilty in September in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to one count of sexual exploitation of a child. There is no parole in the federal system. Miller admitted to sexually abusing a 7-year-old girl from approximately September of 2020 to March 24th of 2021. A search of Miller's email address revealed 6 photos of the child taken while he was abusing her. Miller, who was convicted in Nebraska in 2016 for possession of child pornography, initially faced 3 additional counts of possession of child pornography and commission of a felony involving a minor while being required to register as a sex offender. Those charges were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. It's time now for the obituaries, and we have 2 of them today. The first one from Sioux City, Angeline Irene Kilker, that's K-I-L-K-E-R, Angeline Irene Kilker of Sioux City, 99 years old, passed away Tuesday, March 14th. Services will be 10 a.m. Monday, March 20th at Faith Lutheran Church. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be 9:30 a.m. Condolences may be directed to MeyerBrosChapels.com. And from Kingsley, Iowa, Michael Mike J. Henrich, that's H-E-N-R-I-C-H. Michael or Mike J. Henrich of Kingsley, 65 years old, passed away Tuesday, March 14th. Arrangements are with Road Funeral Home in Kingsley, Iowa. All right, let's move to some sports now, and we'll start with some high school basketball. Panthers rally for win. Second half surge sends Dakota Valley to title game. This by Dave Driesen and Dateline Sioux Falls. Trailing by 9 points at halftime to a hot shooting Hamlin team, Dakota Valley's 51-game winning streak appeared to be in serious peril. The defending champions came out looking like a different team in the second half, going on a 19-0 run to start the third quarter and held for a 77-63 win in the South Dakota Class A semifinals Friday night at Denny Sanford Premier Center in Sioux Falls. Dakota Valley, seeking the second title in school history, will meet the winner of the Elk Point Jefferson Sioux Falls Christian game in the finals at 7:45 p.m. Saturday. Results of that contest were too late for the Journal's deadline for Saturday's paper. Senior guard Isaac Bruns, who was named South Dakota's Gatorade Player Friday, recorded a double-double with 27 points and 12 rebounds. Senior point guard Randy Rosenquist contributed 20 points, and junior forward Jackson Wingert added another 18. The Panthers, who never trailed in Thursday's quarterfinal blowout win over Hot Springs, fell behind quickly versus Hamlin, as Brennan Kessler scored the first 4 points on a basket and reverse layup with less than a minute gone in the game. Bruns cut the lead to 4-3 after sinking 3 straight free throws after being fouled on a 3-point shot. Dakota Valley took their biggest lead of the half, 7-4 lead on a pane of free throws from Jackson Wingert, and a Rosenquist drive-in layup. I think the writer was a little tired last night. Neuendorf then tied the game on a 3-pointer, the first in a barrage of attempts by the Chargers that found the bottom of the net in the first half. After Rosenquist's layup put the Panthers back on top 9-7, Tyson Stevenson and Zach Van Meetren hit consecutive trays to give Hamlin a 13-9 lead. Neuendorf's driving layup as time expired put the Chargers up 23-18 at the end of the first quarter. The Panthers trailed throughout the second quarter as the Chargers continued to drain open shots and their defense frustrated Dakota Valley shooters. After Bruns hit two free throws to Hamilton to lead 29-20. After Bruns hit 2 free throws to Hamlin to lead 29-24. This is written very badly. Hamlin went on a 10-4 run as Van Meetren had a 3-pointer, which gave the Chargers their largest lead of the half, 39-28. As Bruns rebounded the bucket, A Bruins rebound bucket cut the lead to 39-30 at halftime. Hamlin finished the first half hitting 55.6% of their shots from the field, including 9 out of 16 from beyond the arc for 56.3%. The Panthers shot just 43.5% from the field and only 1 of 4 shots from beyond the arc for 25%. Quote, "I think we probably got a little too cute changing our defense in the first half," end quote, Dakota Valley head coach Jason Kleiss said. Continuing the quote, "We just didn't have a mindset of getting after them. They were the aggressor the whole time." Continuing the quote, "I felt like we really just got punched in the mouth and were back on our heels. I felt fortunate to be only down by 9. We could have been down 15 pretty easily," end quote. At the intermission, Kleiss switched to a straight-up man-to-man defense and put Hennies on Neuendorf and Sam Faldmo on Stevenson. Quote, "Those two did a tremendous job and stepped up. That was a big key," end quote, Kleiss said. Dakota Valley's stepped-up defensive pressure largely shut down the Chargers' long-range shooting game in the second half. Hamlin shot just 29.2% from the field in the final two quarters and 21.4% from three-point range. The Panthers, meanwhile, were a blistering 58.6% from the field in the second half and 2 of 6 from downtown. The Panthers dominated the Chargers on the glass in the second half, winning the rebound battle 41-28 after leading only 14-11 at halftime. Winger started the 19-0 scoring run to start the second half with a lay-in, drawing a foul and exciting his teammates and the large Dakota Valley crowd. The 6'7" senior scored 12 of his 18 points in the final half. Quote, we really got it inside early, which we hadn't done in the first half," Kleiss said. "When Wingert gets going, he's kind of the engine emotionally for us. So we got a bucket right out of the half, and I think our defense stepped up." On the next two possessions, Bruns hit a jumper after stealing the ball and then tipped in a missed shot to pull the Panthers to within two, 39-37. A Henny's three-pointer gave Dakota Valley its first lead since the first quarter, 40-39, with 5:36 left in the quarter. Consecutive baskets by Wingert, Bruns, and Rosen in a Rosenquist traditional three-point play gave the Panthers a double-digit lead, 49-39, with 3:58 left in the quarter. Two free throws left by Luke Bruns put Dakota Valley up 56-43 at the end of the period, in which the Panthers outscored the Cavaliers 26-4 in the period. Dakota Valley increased its lead at the start of the final stanza. Rosenquist picked up one of his team-high 9 assists, throwing a baseball-like pass to Wingert, who laid it in. Bruns followed with a tip-in, and Wingert hit two free throws to put the Panthers up 65-48 with 4:08 left. Hamlin pulled within 12 points on an Evan Stormo jumper with 1:13 left in the game, but consecutive baskets by Sam Faldmo and Wingert pushed the lead back up to 15. On the front page of the sports section, it shows Dakota Valley's Isaac Bruns driving to the basket as Hamlin's Tyson Stevenson chases after him during the Class A South Dakota Boys Basketball Tournament game Friday at the Denny Sanford Premier Center in Sioux Falls. Defending champion Dakota Valley rallied in the second half to win 77-63. On page B4, it also shows two other inset pictures. Dakota Valley's Randy Rosenquist shooting during the Class A semifinal Friday at the Denny Sanford Premier Center in Sioux Falls. Rosenquist scored 20 points as the Panthers won. And another picture shows Dakota Valley's Jackson Wingert driving to the basket and into Hamlin's Dawson Gnome during semifinal round action at the Class A South Dakota Boys Basketball Tournament Friday at the Denny Sanford Premier Center in Sioux Falls. Next, we'll move to some college wrestling. Wayne State wrestlers place 17th at Nationals. The state line, Wayne, Nebraska. The Wayne State College wrestling team finished 17th in the team standings at last week's National Collegiate Wrestling Association National Tournament in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The Wildcats won the Academic School of the Year award based on the GPA of its qualifiers. All 14 Wildcat wrestlers qualified for the NCAA Nationals and compiled a team record 21 wins at the national tournament. Bellarmine University of Louisville, Kentucky won the meet. Leading Wayne State's qualifiers was freshman Gavin Zauka, who finished 4-2 at 165 pounds and made it to the round of 12, one match short of All-American status. Going 3-2 were Chase Eggleston, a freshman, at 157 pounds, and Chance Shulin, a sophomore, at 165 pounds. The following wrestlers won two matches: Clayton Harris, a sophomore, at 149 pounds, Dylan Zauka, sophomore, 174 pounds, and Isaac Vuberil, sophomore, at 174 pounds. Also winning matches and adding to the team score were Colby Puck, a sophomore, at 141, Landon Templer, freshman, at 149 pounds, Muhammad Sido, a sophomore, at 157 pounds, Dakota Spann, freshman, 184 pounds, and Tyler Daw, a freshman, at 235 pounds. The NCAA is made up of club teams that are not varsity-level sports at their respective teams. Chose an inset picture of the Wayne State Wrestling Club, pictured with medals and trophies, and there's a lot of hardware there, won at the National Collegiate Wrestling Association Southwest Conference National Qualifying Meet. The team recently placed 17th at the national meet, and pictured are Dylan Zauka, Gavin Zauka, Chase Eggleston, Chance Shulin, Colby Puck, Muhammad Sido, and Clayton Harris. Also Lane Barton, Tyler Daw, Anthony Scala, Landon Templer, Coach Greg Vanderweil, also Dakota Spann, Jared Engel, and Isaac Vuberil. Moving now to some college women's basketball. Huskers versus Panthers in women's NIT. Nebraska to host Northern Iowa in second round on Sunday. The Nebraska women's basketball team will play Northern Iowa in the second round of the WNIT at 2 p.m. Sunday at Pinnacle Bank Arena. The Huskers kicked off tournament play with a 74-65 home win against Missouri State on Wednesday. Nebraska didn't learn its second round opponent or tip-off time until Thursday when Northern Iowa defeated Colorado State. Nebraska drew a crowd of 4,116 on Wednesday and will look to attract more fans in a more favorable Sunday afternoon slate. The game will be available to be streamed on ESPN+. Northern Iowa is 23-9 and went 16-4 in Missouri Valley Conference play. The Panthers get the brunt of their offense from three players: Grace Bofalai, who has 16.3 points per game, Maya McDermott, 14.3, and Emerson Green at 11.2. Sunday will mark the first meeting between the teams since 2016, when Northern Iowa eliminated Nebraska in a first-round WNIT game with a 64-62 win. The winner of Sunday's game will advance to the Sweet 16 round of the 64-team tournament. The WNIT bracket consists of four quadrants, but there are no seeds in an effort to reduce travel and group teams that are close geographically. It shows an inset picture of Nebraska's Jazz Shelley shooting a three-point shot against Missouri State as Maggie Mendelson boxes out defenders during a first-round WNIT game Wednesday at Pinnacle Bank Arena. The Huskers will host Northern Iowa in the second round on Sunday. Looking at some more college women's basketball, Clark and Cezano lead Iowa. Iowa drug Southeast Louisiana in NCAA first round. This Dateline Iowa City. Caitlin Clark at 26 points and 12 assists, and Monica Cezano added 22 points as Iowa defeated Southeastern Louisiana 95-43 in a women's NCAA tournament first-round game on Friday. Hannah Stolke added 13 points for the Hawkeyes, the second seed in Seattle Regional 4. Iowa is 27-6, will play number 10 seed Georgia in the second round on Sunday. Clark, an Associated Press first-team All-American who was third in the nation in scoring at 27 points per game, added 7 assists. She was 9 out of 14 from the field. Sinano, third in the nation in field goal percentage after leading the nation in that category the last two seasons, was 10 of 12 from the field. She added 8 rebounds. The Hawkeyes playing in front of a sellout crowd, 14,382, never trailed. They led 28-17 at the end of the first quarter and 54-32 at halftime. Iowa shot 60.6% in the first half, 60% for the game. Iowa's defense led the Lady Lions to just 25.4% shooting for the game, including 3 of 32 from the field in the second half. Southeastern Louisiana, 21-10, the number 15 seed that was the Southland Conference regular season and tournament champion, was making its first NCAA tournament appearance. Sierra Cunningham led the Lady Lions with 15 points. Underneath it says, big picture, Southeastern Louisiana. The Lady Lions came into the game ranked 14th in scoring defense, allowing just 54.5 points per game, but the Hawkeyes passed that early in the second half. Still, the Lady Lions never seemed rattled, playing in front of the largest crowd they've seen all season until the second half. Iowa, the Hawkeyes remember last season's second-round exit and a loss to Creighton at home, and they came out strong in the game. The Hawkeyes turned... I think I jumped to the wrong section there. No, I got it right. The Hawkeyes turned in one of their better defensive performances of the season. It's time now for Dear Abby. And the first letter today is from Hurting in the Midwest. The title is Partner in Need Doesn't Have a Partner Indeed. Dear Abby, I have been with my boyfriend for 11 years, and all of this time he has never once asked me if I'm okay whenever I've gotten hurt. I got used to it, you might say. Well, I recently lost the ability to walk and ended up in a nursing home for rehabilitation. My boyfriend would come to visit but would never ask about progress. Furthermore, when I would show him my progress, he wouldn't act happy. Now I'm home, and he treats me like garbage. I don't know why. When I brought it up, he said he doesn't know why. Should I end this relationship so I can find someone who's supportive and who will help me get back to 100%? Or should I stay and work on this relationship? I'm less and less happy every day. Signed, Hurting in the Midwest. Dear Hurting, your boyfriend of 11 years is not a nurturer. That he doesn't ask if you are hurt or injured shows he lacks empathy. If I had to hazard a guess, I would opine that he treats you like garbage now because he's mad at you for needing his help and support. No amount of working on this will fix what's missing in his character. Unless you want to be treated like this for the rest of your life, get rid of him. Next letter is from About to Pop Off. Dear Abby, I have a coworker I share an office with. We are cordial, but not friends. The problem is she chews gum most of the day with her mouth open and occasionally pops it. The noises she makes are extremely disturbing and they disgust me. I have taken to wearing headphones and listening to music as often as possible to tune out her noises, but it feels a bit rude and it isn't practical for all day. I'm on the verge of snapping at her. Is there a kind way I can alert her of the problem without disrupting our working relationship? Signed, About to Pop Off. Dear Pop, have a congenial chat with this coworker and ask her to let you know when she's going to pop in a piece of gum so you can pop on your headphones. It beats popping your cork in frustration. Last letter is from Younger Guy in California. Dear Abby, I'm friends with a man in his late 70s, 20 years my senior. I'm concerned about his mobility. He's an independent spirit who lives alone. Lately, I have noticed his strength and balance are diminished, and I know falls are serious for seniors. I have shared my worries with him, but he's proud and won't change his habits. Can you recommend a way I can talk to him constructively about my concerns? Signed, Younger Guy in California. Dear Younger Guy, you have already tried discussing this with your friend. You might be able to get through to him if you tell him you have noticed his balance issues and that there is help for him if he tells his doctor what has been happening. A physical therapist may be able to help him remedy his problem, but only if he asks. Taking one last look at the weather today, it's going to be brisk and cold today. A high of 22 degrees, winds northwest at 15 to 25 miles an hour. Then it gets really cold, frigid on tonight, a low down to 6 degrees above zero tonight, and winds northwest at 7 to 14. Then it gets better on Sunday. Plenty of sunshine, not as cold, a high of 44 degrees for tomorrow. Wind south-southwest at 8 to 16 miles an hour. Mostly clear skies Sunday night, low 25. And then on Monday, partly sunny and milder, high reaching 51 degrees. And I think we're finally into spring. Then south-southwest winds at 8 to 16 miles an hour for Monday. Monday night, a low of 29 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. On Tuesday, some sun, then turning cloudy again. A high of 52, though, and wind south-southeast at 8 to 16. Tuesday night, cloudy skies, low of 37, and cloudy on Wednesday. A couple of rain showers possible, but a high of 53 degrees and winds east-northeast at 8 to 16 miles an hour. And that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, March 18th, 2023. For the last hour, the stories have been selected and read by yours truly, John Reef. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, you can call IRIS toll-free at 877-404-4747. Boy, I forgot the number. It's been a while. We thank you for listening to IRIS, your radio reading service.